Well, hello everyone. Welcome to LSE, to the Department of Management's public discussion. I'm Saul Estrin. I'm a professor of the management in the department, and we're very pleased to be hosting this this event. And it's a great honour also to welcome back LSE alumna Sherry Kutu to this stage, where 2 years ago she actually launched the Scale Up report. Now, as you may know, Sherry is a former CEO. She's an entrepreneur. She's an angel investor. She serves on boards of companies, of charities, and of universities. And she's also the author of the Government Commission's Scale Up report, which sought to explain how a boost of maybe 1% to UK scale up population could drive more than 200,000 jobs and add tens of billions to GDP over a 3-year horizon. Well, it's very appropriate to be discussing this issue, I think, of scale-up in the UK right now, with this, our greatly increased economic and political uncertainty, and where the role of new firms is really critical, I think, to successful economic performance. But the scale-up report stresses, and I think quite rightly, that the issue is not just the creation of firms. If you compare the UK with, say, Germany or southern European countries, we create firms very, very quickly and very effectively, much faster rate of firm creation. But the issue is concerns their rate of survival and their rate of growth. Now, I've just returned, in fact, from China. In fact, one or two of the students from that one, indeed, is sitting here now. And we held there a very interesting panel on entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial finance. And it was very interesting to see that even in China, many of the same issues that are faced in the UK are faced in China. Particularly, this was about, the panel was about the difficulty in creating new firms and particularly the difficulty of getting finance for new firms. As I say, what makes the scale-up report so interesting is that their concern is not about this issue of forming firms, it's about getting firms to grow. And, of course, that process of growth is the process that generates the added value and it's the process that generates the employment. And so I think that's why it's of particular policy relevance. So Sherry's going to consider the first 2 years' work of the Scale Up Institute and the economic impact of high-growth firms in the UK. And she's going to be joined in this by Irene Graham, who's also on the table up there, and Chris Haley, head of startup. Now, sorry, Irene is the Scale Up Institute's inaugural CEO, I should have said. And Chris Haley, also on the desk over there, who's the head of startups and new technology research, and he works with Nesta. And they're all three of them going to be talking tonight about the report. Now, this is going to be a somewhat highly choreographed evening. So the plan here is that we're going to hear from Sherry and the others who are going to give a presentation for around 25 minutes. And then they're going to stand down and we're going to be getting industry representatives from particular locations so we can understand something about particular or specific regional ecosystems for scale-up across the UK. And we're going to hear from, I hope, four of those. And then when they've finished, we're going to go to a broader Q&A. So it's a three-part thing, and those of you who have lots of questions, if you can just hold them in check while we do these two different sets of presentations, that would be very, very good. I'd just like to say a couple more remarks. I think, as you know, this is the Global Entrepreneurship Week, and it's very nice to be talking about Scale Up Britain in the LSE during this week. When Sherry was on the stage here 2 years ago, she revealed it was when she was studying at LSE that she first, in the late 1980s, that she first heard the word entrepreneur. And it was here that she was first told that she was entrepreneurial. And I think it's very clear that Sherry has stayed absolutely true to that conviction and to those words. And now at LSE, entrepreneurship and innovation is part of our core fabric. And many of our academics are researching both on scale-ups and particularly on entrepreneurship, and as you've heard, not only within the UK, but on with a global reach. For those of you who are interested, I might add that if you're interested in the research, the LSE's Management with Impact blog outlines some of the works that we're working on. And also, LSE is very concerned not only with entrepreneurship, but social entrepreneurship, and the department is going to launch a new one-year master's in social innovation and entrepreneurship in 2017, and those of you who are interested in learning more about that will find it on, I guess, the departmental website. So I think I've outlined the format. After your Q&A, there will be a drinks reception outside this lecture theatre, and you'll be able to continue conversations. Those who want to go online, the Twitter hashtag for today's event is hashtag ScaleUpBritain. And if people could please put their mobile phones onto silent so as not to disrupt things. The intention is to podcast this event if you want to hear it again and again and again. And assuming there are no technological problems, that should be available very quickly. So after that very lengthy introduction, I would like now to welcome Sherry to talk about the Scale Up Manifesto, how Britain is becoming the scale up nation of the world. Sherry. Thank you.
And I can see the clicker, so we can hopefully things will click as they're supposed to. Thank you, Saul. It is absolutely fantastic being back here at the LSE. And it was 1986, so 30 years ago when I came here for my one-year taught master's, and heard about this strange thing called an entrepreneur, and met people from the whole world. And having grown up in a lumber town, the daughter of a civil servant and a union leader, I hadn't heard entrepreneur, and I didn't know that it was an attractive career. And it is indeed an attractive career. And an attractive process. And back on just onto entrepreneurship, I love the definition of entrepreneur. Of an entrepreneur is somebody who leverages assets that they do not own or control to achieve something that people feel need to be achieved. And in that definition, I think all of us in this room are entrepreneurs, one way or the other. So I think it's really fantastic. So thank you for having me back. Hopefully that's going to work. Last time when we were here, I called it the Scale Up Manifesto, and it was a manifesto for change. We wanted to give all of you levers which you could pull to bring about a more prosperous nation, one way or another, one city or another, whichever way you looked at it. So I just want to see in the audience, who here would describe themselves as an entrepreneur? So the center of the thing is an entrepreneur. Who here is already an entrepreneur? Great. And who here is in policy, could be described as a policy? Okay. Culture, really talk about media. Who's here in the media, sort of journalistic sort of bent? Okay. Sports, accounting, legal, great. Human capital, again, that's sort of educationalists. So we call that educationalists. Who here is sort of teachers? I know you are. Good. And markets, large corporates. Who here would be from a large corporates? So not so many large, a couple of large carpets, brilliant. So the reason to bring this up is this talks about the ecosystem. And when you're talking about entrepreneurship and building the prosperity of a nation, you can't point at one person and say, you must do this. It's your fault if it doesn't happen. It's all of us working together. And by working together and by collaborating, we can create or co-create a more prosperous ecosystem that all of us will enjoy. And that's really important. So Saul went through the background, which I'm not going to go through again. But here I'm going to pause a little bit on this slide and talk about why it's just a refresher course, 101. There's a very high relationship between scale-ups and productivity in the nation. The larger a company is, the higher the productivity. So it follows that you need to not only start them, you need to get them to be large. And that's what we're going to be talking about here. And the processes that a leader goes through as they're making their company large, as they're growing it from 5 employees to 50 to 500 to 5,000 employees, they encounter common barriers regardless of what country they're in. It's hard going from 225 to 500 employees, and you feel the same whatever country you're in. So these are common issues, and because they're common issues, there are common ways of addressing these issues, and that's what we're going to talk about. Creating scale-ups create jobs. You talked about the 225,000 jobs, which is correct. In the UK, 4,500 jobs are created every week by scale-ups, and that is three times more than the FTSE 100. But you probably hear about the FTSE 100 more often than you hear about scale-ups. So part of it is just raising the consciousness about the contribution that these rapidly growing companies make to our world. The scale-up jobs are high quality. If you survey people at the jobs they had before they went to a scale-up and after when they are at a scale-up, they are far happier working at a scale-up. And you sort of follows that if you're in a large, possibly shrinking firm that doesn't have innovative products, you wouldn't be that happy. But people were surprised because sometimes the media would have you believe that, oh, you're working 100 hours a day or a month or whatever. You're working way too hard, and it must be horrible working in a scale-up because you'd be working too hard. But you're not working too hard because you're creating something that everybody believes in, and it's actually really fun. And you get more job satisfaction because you can see the impact of what you're doing. And sometimes if you're working for an incumbent firm that perhaps isn't growing, you can't see how what you do makes a difference. And so when you're working at a rapidly growing company, your self-worth goes up and you enjoy it more. So that's good. They are more innovative and more international. So there's been some really good research in the last 2 years showing that the innovation, the internationalization is higher. They are across all sectors. Lots of people think, oh, it's just tech. It's not just tech. It is science, and it is creative. It is manufacturing. It is all of the rich fabric of our nation is growing, and you don't have to be tech to grow quickly. And some of the data that we're releasing shows exactly that, and it's exciting to see that. And they are diverse. And we're going to go through, again, sort of we're looking at, there's 927, I think it says there, women-led scale-ups in the UK, which is good news, and that there's more than 500 of them growing at 50% or more. Now, they will be going through the same growing pains as everybody else, but lots of people say women don't run fast-growing companies, but that's a myth. They run them, and they are all over the country. And they're doing all sorts of things. So you can be in IT, like Catherine is. You can be up in Edinburgh with Genius Foods. You can be in recruitment and staffing, like Bryn is. You can be manufacturing handbags, Cambridge Satchel Company in Cambridge. Or you can be in ad tech and AI in London. They are companies that are adding to the rich fabric of our life every single day, all over the place, and they're not just in London. In fact, the vast majority of them are not in London, and that's kind of exciting. So we like to change the thing. The common issues that you have when you're growing a company from 50 to 500 to 2,000 the first one is that nobody can see them because they're quite rare, so we need to put on the map that they are there. The second is it's very hard if you're growing quickly to hire people quickly enough. So that's what we call the skills gap. The number one issue that people have is finding people. So what you're doing at the LSE and equipping people with the correct skills is highly valuable, and you must do more of it. Thank you. The leadership capacity gap, which we'll talk about again, even in just a large company or a professional services firm, it's quite hard being a leader, and you have to learn different skill sets. If you are in a leadership position and you're having 20 or 30 or 50 or 100% new customers every year, you have to learn even faster, and that causes certain issues which we as a community can help leaders address, particularly those who have done it before can help those as they are doing it. And we're highlighting some of the really great things that are going on that help that. Markets. One of the things I loved about the LSE when I was here is there were, again, 28 different countries in my class. And for some people, it's very natural selling your product in the UK and then also selling it in Japan or India or elsewhere. But for some people who haven't done that before, it seems relatively foreign. And one of the things that we need to do, and we will do, is help first-time entrepreneurs understand how easy it is to sell to other places. And there's some terrific programs that we've found in the last 2 years, which we're going to talk to you about. Finance. You really need to have money, especially if you're expanding rapidly, so that remains very important. And when you're if you're growing from 500 to 1,000, you run out of the real estate that you thought you would need because you're growing faster than you expected. So that's a sticking point. It doesn't mean motorways. It doesn't mean broadband. That affects all businesses, large, small, shrinking, all of them. But particularly outgrowing where you are is an issue for our scale-ups, and it's a solvable problem. So the good thing is all of the problems that there are can be solved, and we know how to solve them. So if we know that, then we can get to work and do what needs to be done. Hence, the Scale Up Institute was, after the report a couple of years ago, about 6 months later, people said, well, like, what are you going to do about it? We need to do something about it. And so it was decided that we would create an institute, which is working, which has been working. These following organizations came together, thank you very, 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 very much, and allowed us to put together funding so that we could hire people like Irene and her team. And what they have been doing for the last year is what we're going to talk to you about tonight, because we want to know where we actually are. So are we doing okay on scale-ups? 2 years ago, we said it would be good if we had more scale-ups as a proportion of the population. And so we set some targets and said it would be great if we had at least one additional scale-up per 100,000 of population. That would be good. So the fabulous news is that that is where we are. In fact, we're slightly ahead of that. So we're ahead of schedule. Woo, we're beating targets. That is fantastic. And what you can see in terms of the numbers is this is what it was in November 2013. This is what it is now. As a percentage of the population, it has grown. It's slightly more than one per 100,000 in the nation. And that is excellent. But there is rich variety hidden in a national number, which I'm now showing you here. And you can see that in some communities, this here shows what your inventory of scale-ups per 100,000 of population is when we started. And this here shows how fast that inventory is growing or shrinking. And we are not all growing at the same rate. So what I think is going to drive our work for the next couple of years is working with each of the cities to help them overcome all of these whatever issues they happen to have. We're going to help them bash them out of the way, because it's unacceptable that you know how to solve a problem and it's still there. So that is sort of outlines our work. We also did an analysis using government information, which is hugely helpful, from Companies House, that looks at the quality of, if you go down to a granular basis, how many companies do you have that have 25 to 50 million, and how many do you have at 50 to 100? And we've done an analysis of where that all is, and if it's in the green area, that means that you've got a nice even spread, and that's good, because if you're trying to put together a program or convene a meeting where you have those who have done it talk to those who are about to do it, making sure you don't have a gap somewhere is very, very helpful. And that shows some of the analysis that we've done that we're releasing at the moment today, about that as well. So now we're going to come over and talk about, I think I'm going to hand over to Irene, who is going to talk about the sectors that there are and what's growing, what's not growing.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit. That's it. So I think we're going to be a bit of a double act here from the stage, Sherry and myself. So thanking all of our partners here, and many of you are here today. We interviewed over September. We did a survey of over 321 of our scale-up leaders, and that really came from across the country: Scotland, the North East, Manchester, South East, South West, West of England. And just the range of sectors that were looked at and responded is there. It emphasises the importance of the fact and the knowledge of the fact that we are a nation of scale-ups across every sector in this country, and that's incredibly important to recognise. We want to talk through some of the key findings from that. You all have in front of you all the high-level findings. We're going to do some deep dive into some of the very critical ones. In 2014, in the report that was commissioned and the recommendations that came from that, one of the very first ones was, well, how can we help scaling businesses if we don't know where they are and if we don't know who they are? We have some great information at Companies House that exists today that we can all access, and in fact the Scale Up Institute has just launched a map showing where the scale-ups are around the country from that data, but it's 18 months old. And if we can access better data that goes in from these businesses to HMRC, VAT, NI records, national insurance, we can do more. So we actually posed that question to the scale-up leaders this year, and we did last year. And a really encouraging fact is that in 2016, 97% of scaling businesses felt the information they give in their records to government should be better used internally in government, but also externally. 90% said 9 out of 10 they would welcome that being used externally to allow the ecosystem, the finances, the corporates to lean in and support them, the educators. Many of them said that would be on an opt-in basis, but the important thing here is a real strong support to this, and this came through in 2015 and 2014, and it's something we're actively working on now. Sherry, do you want to talk about some of the recommendations in relation to that?
Yes. So what we're recommending, so we said before, 2 years ago, you should identify them, and we're going much further now. We're actually saying that we recommend that there's an official scale-up status that that is recognized and that national databases are released, created and released, so that it's really easy for you, if you're in Scotland, to know exactly where the fast-growing companies are, and for those to be up to date. The databases that we have a bit of a delay on them at the moment, and if you are trying to grow your company, you sort of need it at the right time, or you're not sort of need it, you absolutely really need it at the right time. So we're saying that the number one most important thing that government could do would be an official database that recognized those companies that had achieved or were currently showing scale-up status. We're also recommending that the local stakeholders should have the funding that they receive from central government tied to whether or not their strategy addresses and is closing the scale-up gap in their community. And thirdly, we are deepening the recommendation that we made two years ago to have a scale-up minister at a central basis, and saying that each local community should also appoint a scale-up. We don't care if they're called envoy or champion, or it doesn't matter what they're called, but they take responsibility at a local level and work with the central government to make sure that we all can address the scale-up gap in the communities.
So if we then turn to talent and skills in relation to the very critical factor that was part of the research that was done in 2014, we see that 82% of those scaling leaders still are looking for the right skills and talent, both within this country and externally, to come in. That's slightly down from 2015, but the critical factor is the skills, the school system, the education system at universities and business schools. There is still a growing desire to see the right skills coming forward from there. Now, we did pose a question this time of what is the biggest gap in the skills coming out of schools and graduates? And I think that's quite interesting. What this shows is that business skills, sales, negotiating, marketing came very strongly through. Management skills and leadership came within that very strongly through. We all know the need to be resilient and able to lead others, and that came through very strongly, as well as technical skills. So a mix of things, and social there as well. So we really need to recognise this as we look at some of the programmes that are operating, that these things are important to the business leaders that we're looking forward to. When we did get some of the flavour of responses in relation to external players and coming in from overseas, there was quite a strong view around the need to make that easier and much, much easily accessible.
Yes. So the recommendations that we're making around the skills gap are two. One is that the first is the Department for Education and LEPS should make sure that schools, colleges, and universities, students come into contact with their scale-up leaders so that they can understand that this is a very valid career. And second, that there's an API that is made that allows the National Pupils Database to be released so that all of the interventions that are being made at university schools and colleges that are supposed to address the closing of the talent gap can be more quickly surfaced. And the second is to do with the scale-up visa. We're recommending that a visa is introduced to allow companies that are scaling up, that have that official scale-up status that we talked about, so that they can hire whoever they want, whenever they want, as quickly as they want, because they are literally quite conservative in the UK. We turn down customer orders if we don't have people who can fill the jobs take those jobs and fill those orders. And that's really not an excellent situation. So we would love there to be a scale-up visa available within 2 weeks of being asked for the company if it's got the official scale-up status. That will make them accept customer orders, do their internationalization, and do a lot of other things a lot faster and keep on growing.
Turning then to leadership, and this for the very first time becomes the top concern for our scaling businesses, that leadership challenge of how when you're growing and growing fast, how you build that right team, you have the right board, you have the right structure around that to support you. 88%, nearly 9 out of 10 leaders saying they want more help there. They want really much more help from the local community and peer-to-peer networking in the mentoring activity and indeed from our universities and business schools in what their great knowledge can bring towards the leadership building within the local area of the business. And just touching on that, one of the things that we have here today, and I know a number of you in the audience are our leaders from Growth Hubs, Local Enterprise Partnerships, Finance and Entrepreneurs in the local community. We brought that group together in earlier this year in Birmingham and in Manchester to run the Driving Economic Development Through Scale Up Ecosystems course. It was one of the fundamental recommendations of the Scale Up manifesto, which was looking at how could we properly ensure that embedded in a local environment was the understanding of scaling businesses, the understanding of what it takes to actually help those businesses and the tools available to support them. Daniel Eisenberg, a leading academic in the US, an entrepreneur and investor, has worked internationally creating local ecosystems to support scaling businesses. We were fortunate to bring him in to Birmingham and to Manchester this year, supported by Goldman Sachs Foundation and 10,000 Small Business Community and Innovate UK, to really immerse our leaders from 32 of our LEPs and Growth Hubs and from Scotland and Northern Ireland into that environment and really look at then what they developed as local projects. We're going to hear from some of the team today as we move into the panel around what's happening locally. And various things are occurring. We've got the School for Scale-Ups in Cambridge. We have local champions emerging in the environment. And we also have some really strong momentum around scale-up programs supporting leadership talent and the skills agenda emerging from our colleagues around the country, and we'll hear more, as I say, when we chair the panel session.
Is it here? Great. So on the leadership capacity gap, the recommendation this year is that local stakeholders should prioritize matchmaking peers and non-executive directors who have scaled things or at a further stage of their scale-up journey with those who are a little bit earlier on in their journey, and that we as a community should facilitate that. And if I look to the man to my right, we're making specific recommendations that educational establishments should consider as a priority the introduction of highly flexible executive education for the scale-ups that are within a stone's throw of them. So we would like to see that all around the country, particularly because of the regional disparity that we pointed out earlier.
Thank you, Sherry. We'll turn to access to markets, and Chris is going to do a much deeper dive into that. It's been a cornerstone of our work this year, but really strongly coming up the agenda as well, the desire to work more closely with UK corporates, to have that supply chain environment, that collaborative environment, that ability to sell in to large corporates and make that made easier. And I've talked to a lot of the corporates that are in the room today about that journey, and Chris has done some excellent research, which we'll talk on in a moment. The critical factors, initiation and senior management buy-in, was seen to be particularly of key areas of need for our scaling businesses on that journey of activity. And equally, the government was seen to be a key customer as well. Sherry, do you want to talk about our recommendations in that area?
Yep. We've got three recommendations around the access to markets. The first is that public bodies should report on the level of procurement that they are sourcing and the collaboration that they're doing with scale-up companies. on an annual basis, and that their funding should be tied to this amount increasing. The second is that large companies should report on, in their annual reports, the level of procurement they source from scale-up companies and collaboration they have with them. And if they are bidding for government contracts, we think that the bidding should be connected to whether or not they are increasing the amount that they procure from scale-ups. And thirdly, agencies that interact with scale-ups, like the Border Authority, Listing Authority, and HMRC, should have fast-track procedures for scale-ups so that they don't get bogged down in the bureaucracy and slowed down from their growth.
And then I think the other aspect here is the international scene. And so we've just come back from the international agenda, and I think it's really very critical to recognise the importance that our scaling leaders see to that international agenda, the need for help further in expanding abroad, and particularly in companies that are growing at that sort of 11 to 19 employees. I think the other interesting factor is where those businesses are exporting to today. Europe and North America, and those target markets are Europe and North America as well. So exporting to Europe and North America and seeing them as real targets, an opportunity, I think, for this country to also encourage our scaling leaders to think about Asia much more. China, huge potential there. I used to work there very extensively across Asia. Africa and India, we really do need to make sure we're opening those other areas to those businesses and helping them in that journey. Finally, we talk about finance, and that's the focus we will end with today in terms of our highlights of the survey. Finance is a completely essential component to scaling leaders. It's what fuels the business, and VCs are definitely, and the risk capital and the equity, and we've talked a lot with the British Business Bank and others around that risk capital, and is it locally available as much as is needed. But the good news is that is still not seen as a top priority, and it is going down, so more to be done in that regard, and we will work and continue to work with our colleagues. I'm going to end there. I said Chris was going to take us through much more the work we've been doing on corporate collaboration and procurement. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you. I might stand, but I think better if I'm walking and facing. So good evening, everyone. My name is Chris Haley from Nesta, the Innovation Foundation. As Irene says, I'm going to spend a few minutes having a deeper dive into one of the areas that we've explored, which is access to markets. So Nesta has been working with the Scale-Up Institute for the last year and a half, trying to understand this area a little bit better, in particular trying to understand more about collaboration between small companies and large companies, why this might work or why this might not work. So am I going backwards here?
You should be going to your slide show, I think, should be up there. Have the team got Chris's slides there? Lucy?
Yeah, okay, great. So just to reiterate, you know, why does this matter? Why do we care about scale-ups? Some of you will have seen this before. This is Nesta work called the Vital 6%. Really just making the point that growth in any economy is really very, very inhomogeneous, right? In the UK, more than 50% of jobs really come from about 6% of firms, those high-growth firms, the ones that are scaling rapidly. And that's true across sectors, it's true across time, and it's true across geography. So if you look at Kenya, Uganda, Jordan, all of these countries have similar distributions in terms of a very small section of firms being the ones who are really growing very, very fast and creating the new jobs. So as Sherry said at the start, if we can change that 6% into 7%, the economic benefits of that really are quite tremendous. So I'm going to talk about one thing in particular, which is around a route to achieving scale through better access to markets and corporate collaboration. So when I talk about corporates, some of you will probably have an image in mind. Some of you will think of corporates as these kind of predatory beasts. And, you know, that's understandable. I've spent many, many years talking with startups and scale-ups, and there is a natural fear of working with larger companies. But we've also spoken about ecosystems. Sherry mentioned this. The startup world likes talking about ecosystems. And I think actually this image here on the right is more appropriate. That the message I want to get across is this is really about a kind of mutualistic symbiosis rather than a predatory relationship. So to put that into numbers, I'm pleased to say I think that large companies are thinking in terms of mutualistic arrangements. And I genuinely think there has been a shift in the way that large companies work with smaller companies that has taken place over about the last 5 years or so. So some numbers here, nearly 90% of large companies say that working with smaller companies is now absolutely part of their innovation agenda, and that wasn't true 5 or 10 years ago. Some work that we did looking at accelerator programs across Europe, more than one in three accelerators is now run by or sponsored by a corporate, and again, that was simply not true 5 years ago. Most of the acquisitions by corporates are of young startups and scale-ups, and there has been a doubling in the number of corporate venturing units in the last 5 years. So I generally do think there has been a sea change here in the way that large companies approach smaller companies. In fact, I would say that effective collaboration really has become a source of competitive advantage for firms. I'm not just talking about procurement, by the way. Procurement is very, very important, but actually there's a range of different mechanisms by which large companies interact with small companies, and they do so for a variety of different reasons. Sometimes this is about solving particular problems. Sometimes this is about achieving cultural change. A number of different reasons. Sometimes actually companies are not quite clear, to be frank, why they're interacting. In terms of what's in it for the smaller companies, it's very clear that actually finance is not top of the list for many of the smaller companies that we have spoken to. There are lots of benefits other than pure finance. Some of this is about enhanced visibility, access to new markets, market insight, routes to market, really very, very important for the smaller companies. But why doesn't this happen as effectively as we would like? Well, many, many barriers crop up time and time again, particularly around speed of interaction. Speed is an absolute killer for small companies. So we have to understand why this interaction is not as fast as it should be. We've done a little bit of work to try and understand these barriers. In our view, they break down into a number of different dimensions, but the real focal area, in my view, should be around the internal barriers on the corporate side. Startups and scale-ups simply do not have the absorptive capacity to really change, but the corporates do. So I think we can break down this area of internal barriers into subsets around strategic issues, cultural issues, structural issues, and procedural issues. I'm not going to say an awful lot about this right now, but basically just to say I've put out some reports at the front here, so please have a look at those, and that expands in a bit more detail about what we mean by these barriers. Just to summarise in the last 1 minute, some recommendations for corporates. I mean, my principal recommendation here is big companies have to make it easier for small companies to work with them. And there really are some very, very simple, straightforward things that people can do. Having a single access point for smaller companies, it is trivial, it costs next to nothing, but initiating the relationship is a problem reported time and time again by startups and scale-ups. On the scale-up side, a problem that we find large companies report very frequently is people actually not being very good at salesmanship. It comes back to some of the skills that we've already mentioned. Too many smaller companies pitching around the technology rather than about the solution that they're offering, rather than about understanding the pain point of the large company and how they fit into that. A number of other points here, but in the interest of time, I'm going to wrap up there. Just to say that this is all expanded on in the report Scaling Together, which we wrote in conjunction with the Scale-Up Institute. You can download it from the URL that I've listed there, or you can pick up some copies from the front here. Okay, thank you.
Okay, we go to the second course of this banquet. I'd like now to call onto the stage Elizabeth Vega, who's the CEO of Informed Solutions, Rowena Burns, who's the CEO of Manchester Science Partnerships, Rob Perks, who's the CEO of Inspire, and James Stewart, who's the Managing Director of Entrepreneurial Scotland. And the way this is going to work, as I understand it, is Irene is going to ask the panelists questions, and they're going to respond sitting here.
Yes, thank you very much. And this is our opportunity to really hear from around the country. And it's a whistle-stop tour, and we'll then be moving into Q&A with the audience. So if I may actually ask our panellists, Elizabeth, Rowena, James and Rob, firstly, to introduce yourselves and who you are, what you do, and why scale-ups matter to you. And then we'll talk as well a little bit about what's happening in each of your areas. So, Elizabeth, we've just been talking about scale-ups. You are a scale-up leader. You are the businesses we're talking about. How does it reflect for you what we've just heard across this last 20 minutes?
Yes, we're a scale-up, and we reinvented ourselves about 5 or 6 years ago after the last Great Recession, and we decided to set ourselves out to be elastic, resilient, and relevant, really, to the new market that was emerging, that global market. We're digital, so we do digital transformations at very large scale and big data and analytics, so I guess we're one of the sectors that's doing well. Why are scale-ups important to us? I mean, other than we're one of them, we need allies. We need to work alongside other scale-ups so that our joint ambitions actually get us further. And I think being part of a scale-up is also learning to collaborate with others rather than not necessarily being part of an opaque supply chain and neither being off on your own trying to do things and change the world.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Rowena, you hosted us in Manchester at Manchester Science Park. Tell us more.
I have to say I didn't know which hand to put up when you were doing your sector analysis. I run a business called Manchester Science Partnerships. It's a partnership, as the name implies, between our two largest universities in the city, the public authorities in the city, the private sector, and a bunch of NHS trusts. It's been around for 30 years. We are for profit. We've been profitable every year in that last 30 years. But the really important thing about how we work is that, yes, we provide space for businesses at every stage of growth. We've got about 300 of them currently, spread across three campuses, all in, broadly speaking, the science or technology sectors, all in sectors that are knowledge-rich, innovation-driven, and young and growing and flourishing. The way that we work with those businesses is pivotal to this discussion tonight, because we work within them, inside them, to understand their needs at every stage of their growth. Because we get that knowledge, we can then leverage the power of our partnerships with our shareholders and with other stakeholders. Manchester is a city of partnerships. We leverage those relationships to take initiatives that help to grow the sectors. And in the regional cities, it's really important to get national facilities and kind of major corporates locating here to kind of get the supply chain right in the city. Because we do that, we can contribute more generally to the policy debate. And we've used the word ecosystem once tonight. That is really how an ecosystem works, mm-hmm. I think. And because we know all that, we kind of understand what is getting in the way for these scale-ups when it comes to taking that next big step up. It's a wonderful world to be working in.
Marina, thank you. And we'll come back to that civic leadership side. James, you've come down from Scotland today. Tell us what's happening there and what Entrepreneurial Scotland does.
Well, there's quite a lot. So, James Stewart, I'm Managing Director of Entrepreneurial Scotland. Our vision is to help make Scotland the most entrepreneurial society in the world. No small task, but there's a number of things which are going on which are going to take us in that direction, we believe. One of which is, as an organisation ourselves, it's been mentioned before, that peer-to-peer network. That's one of the things which we think is particularly important, and that indeed is what we are, a membership organisation based around that. But there's much more that's possible, and for us, this element about scale-ups is really it's a bottleneck in a pipe. If you invest all of your energy into the startups, and indeed I think it's fair to say Scotland was putting a lot of effort into that, as indeed were many others. And what happens next? You reach a point where actually the real return, that opportunity for that to return back to the economy, for that to return into jobs, is somewhat missed. And so what's happening at the moment, and we can perhaps pick up more of this further through the discussion, is that redressing that balance and starting to make sure that actually not only are companies supported well early, but they're supported to really go through that phase where those biggest returns start to become the fruits to bear.
Thank you, James. And Rob, if you were looking at that photo very closely, Rob was in it that we showed earlier. He was in the inaugural course that happened in Birmingham. Rob, tell us about your role as a CEO at Inspire and what that entails and what you've been doing.
Evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Simon says, I'm CEO at Inspire. We were actually started life as a services company for the Chambers of Commerce across the area, supplying marketing services and eventually moving towards business support services. We won the contract in 2013 to run the Swindon and Wiltshire Growth Hub. And the concept, for those who might not be quite so familiar with Growth Hubs, the concept was to bring all support for businesses into one place. So it was much easier to access for a business, because it is every business you talk to would tell you the landscape is just very confusing and difficult to access, and there are so many access points. So that was the point of that. I think it's fair to say the first 3 years of our life, we were very involved in the Growth Hub in supporting startups. And a statistic we love to go around and talk about was the fact that 94% of the businesses we supported to start up actually were still surviving 2 years later. So it was always nice to say, well, actually, hopefully we made a difference. What we didn't really focus on was the fact that those businesses often didn't scale. So only a very tiny proportion of those startups, yes, they survived and became viable businesses, they were still very small and stayed small. And I think the big difference that we've seen this year in getting stuck into the scale-up work is that actually to make a real impact on the economy, you need a good proportion of those to be scaling. And I think it's the case, I think I'm right in saying nationally, the number that actually do scale up and become large is actually quite a small percentage. But they're the people that will actually make the real difference to the economy in general, rather than the very, very small businesses that stay small. So our work since May this year, and the course that Irene referred to is what set us going on this journey, really, was to say, how can we actually identify the businesses that are capable, ambitious, and have the opportunity to really scale up, but they do need to access the right kind of help to get them to do it. And that's been what we've been doing since May.
Thanks, Rob. Marina, you talked about the collaboration space between city leaders. There's a lot of people in an ecosystem. You hosted a dinner for us there. What do you think are the key ingredients of success, really, in making a city and an area work effectively? And how do you do that to make it really make it a difference? Because it is a challenging situation to try and work across multiple stakeholders.
It is very challenging, and in a way, I think the place we have been in Greater Manchester over the last year or so is one whereby there is so much going on, so many collaborations and partnerships, that landscape that you described a moment ago is potentially very confusing for businesses, has indeed been quite confusing for businesses. And so I think one of the things that inspired me, I have to say, about the Scale Up Institute report, actually, was the opportunity to bring partners together and try to straighten out some of the spaghetti. And I know from the what businesses tell us is that one size does not fit all in terms of what businesses need, and that therefore working from the inside out, identifying your fastest growing businesses and working with them not to make their needs fit the programs that you've got for them, but to make the programs fit the needs of the business is absolutely critical to success here. And one other point I would just make, actually, that I think is an opportunity for us at the moment, is that the private sector has got so involved in working on this agenda, both as the provider of services directly, but also in their brokerage and ability to work across the supply chain, to supply mentors, to supply non-execs to sit on boards, to supply access to investment, that there's almost a bit of healthy competition going on between the private sector and the public sector. So part of the point of that dinner was to say, how do we get in a place where all of this is synergistic?
And Elizabeth, you've been quite heavily involved. I mean, you are operating nationally. You're based in North East in Scotland. You're international as well. What do you think the cities and the local areas need to do to make the spaghetti more readable, the language, the focus more understandable?
I think regional hubs and regional development is key. It can't all happen in the capital cities, otherwise you get two economies, really, and we need to spread that. We need to spread that capability and that investment and obviously improve opportunities for everyone. It is about establishing connections, providing the right forums for people to meet other like-minded individuals, whatever your maturity is, your business maturity, or whatever your ambitions. I mean, you can segment that. So financial institutions, I think, can help, potentially, for example, helping co-design products. not every scale-up wants VC investment. Some of them are quite mature, like ourselves, 25 years. And so we may not be inclined to give away half of our company for a couple of million pounds, for example. I'm making it up, but you get the idea. So, you know, you can collaborate with local, regional financial institutions, other local organisations or regional organisations that want to export, so create almost like consortias, because you have similar ambitions and you have complementary services. I think it's about architecturing or curating different groups. Academia is really important as well, because you may have different regional investments, whether it's smart cities or it's energy, and so the local educational institutions can help provide the local talent and also industry engagement.
And indeed are a great convener as well. Absolutely. I saw you nodding along there, actually, James. Tell us a little bit more about what Scotland's doing in terms of some of the Scottish enterprise activity as well.
Yes, so there's a number of different elements. You may or may not be familiar with Scotland Can Do, which is a sort of shared statement of intent, and it's trying to help focus that attention to, in its own way, encourage the spaghetti to sort of line up and help people get a little better clarity. And that's not just clarity for the consumer in terms of the businesses themselves, it's actually the different ecosystem partners that are in their own rights having a better and clearer understanding of the part they play and how that contributes. Specifically, we expect to see some work which has been conducted over the last few months come to fruition next year around a backbone organisation with a view to unlocking that collective impact opportunity. What I mean by that is to sort of take the ingredients, and we have tremendous ingredients, I think, around Scotland in particular, more broadly, and revisit that recipe to just actually help to get the very most out of it.
And is it right that I hear you've got sort of account? I mean, Sherry talked about scale-up champions. Account. Is that something that's going to evolve?
That's right. So, of those different partners, one in particular, of course, is the enterprise agencies in Scotland, Scottish Enterprise being the largest of those. They've specifically responded to this particular agenda by, of their broader account management portfolio, to really focus in on 50 that have got that, not only meet these criteria, but have considerable potential as well. And so it's actually sort of matching the sort of the criteria itself in terms of current, but also looking into the distance about what they're doing. And I think that's very exciting. There's some great resources and support there, and I would fully expect to see that have considerable traction in the coming years.
Yeah, I know you want to throw it to the audience a minute. I want to come to Rob and Rowena in a minute. Rob, when we met last, you had a group of 80-odd businesses in the room. I mean, just tell us the journey of really sort of talking to these scaling businesses to bring them into the journey that they're on with you now.
Okay. So we started this, as I've mentioned earlier, in May, really following the scale-up conference in Birmingham. And first of all, obviously, we sat down and said, well, what can we offer these businesses? And I think I'd like to just, for the purposes of tonight, just summarise that into two things. One is to bring them together, to help businesses work better together, to learn from each other, and to benefit from linking together, not necessarily to do business, but to learn from each other. So that's sort of one half of it. And the other half is really to do what the growth hubs have always done, which is to sit down with each individual business and to say, how can we work out with you, what are the things in your business that are preventing growth? What are your evidence gaps, if you like? What are those things that are really stopping you getting to the next level? And let's link you with the right people to unblock those. We're not arrogant enough to suggest that we know the answers to all of those things, or we've got the expertise for all of those things. Hopefully, having worked in corporate environments and small business environments in the past, we've got enough knowledge to be able to help them work out who they need to talk to unblock the gaps. So they're the two really big things that we're doing. And then we started to go out and talk to businesses. Some of them we already knew. Some we didn't, and we talked to around about 100 businesses over that period. Around about 80 have actually come along and been part of this group. The thing that was quite surprising, I have to say, is how well it was received. So this is a group that felt like the forgotten children, it seems. They felt a lot of effort had been put into startups in the past, a lot of effort. Corporates are really important to the economy. But actually, this group in the middle, the medium and SME, have been really quite neglected. So there was actually a feeling like, oh, somebody cares about us. So it was actually very well received. And I think about 90-odd percent of the businesses that we went to talk to actually said, yeah, we want to actually be part of this.
And they truly are across every sector. I sat around printing, tech, from manufacturing to everything. Rowena, we're in an education establishment. I see your Manchester University colleagues are there. Just one word on what the educationers can do before I hand back to Saul to then bring in the audience to the Q&A.
Gosh, that was a great cue. It was the top of my list of things I wanted to say. I find it extraordinary in this country that people still go to school, finish their education, start work, work until they retire. We live in such a fast-moving world where most of the jobs that are going to exist in 5 years' time don't exist today. We need to create an interchange between learning and work, which becomes as normal as anything else that happens to you in your working life. And so I think we're starting to work with our universities now to get more of the scale-up principles into how they teach. We need also to work with businesses so that they become habituated to demanding more of their universities to support their growth.
Thank you. We're going to now open this to the audience all and bring everybody in to have the Q&A. So I'm going to hand over back to you. I think that gave you a whistle-stop tour.
Okay, well, we're zooming fast through this and everyone's got more to say than there is time. Sherry, do you want to come back? So we're now in a good position to open this. There are a lot of issues that I know we didn't have time to get into, and maybe your questions will allow us to get into them in more depth. We've also got some people who are going to run around with microphones because it will be useful for the podcast or whatever if we have recorded what the questions are and if everyone can hear them. So I now throw this open, and the first person is just there.
Thank you. Julian Karen Cumbridge, Fidelio Partners. Fascinating overview and really very inspiring, but it must be the only discussion I've been to in the past 6 months that hasn't mentioned the B word. What does Brexit mean specifically for this sector of
everybody,
the economy?
There was a moment then when people went, what B word?
B word, exactly. Because I think on the whole business feels... this is very difficult to navigate. Big business certainly feels that. Very small businesses feel that. So I'd be very interested, whoever wants to address that question.
Well, I'll take it first, and I think Elizabeth would have an interesting perspective. I mean, the thing that was quite interesting from the survey results that we did, and that was 300-odd leaders across the country, was the aspiration to grow. I mean, the strength of aspiration to grow amongst those leaders is incredible. And they're not thinking the Brexit is going to hold them back. They're saying now, we want to grow. We're expecting to grow more than 20%. We actually, our whole sort of business community was 800 that we went to, and they all had a phenomenal desire to grow, more than even some of the other research organisations. I know BDRC Continental, who regularly interview businesses on finance. I mean, it was almost double the growth aspirations of these businesses. So I think, what we need to be really careful about is not think, oh my gosh, Brexit. I think these businesses are just getting on with it. And I'm going to ask Elizabeth what your view is of that. Maybe I'm putting you on the spot there.
No,
but,
that's all right.
But, we had this conversation, I think, back in June ourselves.
I know. Most of the people I know didn't vote to leave. We were all Remainers. And I think after the initial shock when we woke up in the morning, we called a board meeting. Surprise. We had, interestingly, put some plans in place which we never thought we'd have to invoke. But it's true. I think as an entrepreneur, and I'm from a very large corporate environment, Unilever, Hawker Siddeley, Oracle, you have a very different mindset. You just make the best of it. And for every door that closes, another one opens. And so we're going to make the best of it. And we're going to continue. We've consulted with our banks. We've consulted with our auditors. We've got contingency plans in place, but we're going to crack on.
Anyone else on the panel want to come in?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of our community, I think that comment just there echoes a lot of it. There was definitely a palpable sense of shock in the morning after. We were actually at an event that night before, saw a good number of people over breakfast, and there was this sort of white-faced moment. But actually, on all of the conversations ever since, there's been a sense of, well, it would be great to understand more about what is happening, but in the interim we're just going to get on with it, and actually we're going to go looking doubly hard to see what we can make of it. So it's a sort of a curious blend of, on the one hand, very keen to get a sense of what's the negotiating position, what are going to be the things which actually emerge ultimately, because they of course will have some bearing, but at the very same time a sort of a dogged determination to make the absolute best of it.
Sherry, do you want to wrap up on this?
If you go to the barriers that they face, talent, leadership development, and internationalization, those remain in finance, those remain. Those challenges of growing really, really quickly haven't changed at all. I think making sure that talent can still be obtained from wherever it is really critical. And I know that we're all going to get on with it, but that will be something that needs to be getting on with. And prior to Brexit, it was the most important thing. I can't see it decreasing anytime soon. Corporate leadership development is just as important. So that need doesn't change. Internationalization was important before. Certainly doesn't go down in importance afterwards. So, again, the challenges to individuals who are growing businesses that are quickly hasn't changed. And if there's some barriers, we'll rip them down.
Karen? Sorry, I didn't say before, but could people say their name and affiliation before they ask the question?
Carol O'Connor, owner of a small business myself. Question, first of all, for Sherry, but anyone else who wants to answer, please. You've mentioned leadership development, and what would you characterize as a core quality or skill? I mean, this getting on with it is very British as well, but how does a leader get on with it? What gets them so that they are getting on with it?
For me, it's role models and access to other people who are a little bit further down the chain than you. When I was floating my company, when I was pregnant, I needed access to both women who worked and who had children while they were doing it, and people who had floated. And the thing that was brilliant was that the community of business leaders who have a little bit further down are very generous with their time, and that doesn't cost anything. It's just part of being in a great supportive community, and we need that more than ever. We don't need to hire people who we don't need to hire them. That generosity of spirit, which is in our community, we just need to draw upon, which is hence we're calling on organizations to use their convening power rather than hire an army of people to help. That's not what we're saying. We're saying convene so that those who need help can be put together with the people who have done it before.
Could I pick that up? Two things I would single out. One is vision. If you have started your own business and you're growing your own business, the biggest thing you can give both to the people you want to buy from you and the people who work for you is that vision and constancy of vision, combined with the ability to understand and know what you don't know, and the willingness to go out and look to fill the gaps in your own ability to span across the business.
And that word empowerment idea is you have that vision comes with empowerment as well and the ability to let them run.
Yeah.
But if, again, it goes back, if you can see it, you've got role models, you're convening the 80 people. You sometimes feel very alone, but you're not alone. And it's just allowing, and there's only 0.4% of the population who grows this fast. So if we can allow the identification, then they will find their like-minded people that much more easily rather than feeling alone, because it is very rare to be a scale-up, 0.4% of the business population.
One here.
Yes. Name and affiliation, please.
Hello, my name's Adrian Davis. I work for a company called Winning Moves. I'm just really interested in the definition of scale-ups, because clearly you're identifying them with the benefit of hindsight. So you know them once you've spotted them. And much of the support that you've talked about is working with existing scale-up businesses. I just wonder if you've done any work on identifying characteristics of potential scale-ups so you can identify those that maybe not quite made it, but we can work with them.
Yeah. So a scale-up is a company that started with, and it can be any age, but the minimum is 10 employees, and they have been growing consistently for 2 years at 20% or more. So anybody who's growing at less than 20% or not growing for 2 or 3 years in a row, I would consider pipeline and absolutely in need of nurturing and making sure that they have the aspiration and the ability to get up to 20% growth per annum. So it's really simple. If you're growing at 10%, well, we know who they are because they still file their accounts just like everybody else, and they still do the push their VAT returns. And if they're growing at 10 and they have the aspiration to grow at 20, let's make sure they meet the people that are growing at 20. And if they're 20 and you want to grow at 50, let's make sure that we introduce them to people growing at 50. The role model effect is really, really powerful. The peer-to-peer and the not feeling alone is great. So you need to start them up. because you can't start them up, you can't grow them. And if you're not growing that fast, then and you want to grow faster, then it's really easy. Introduce it to somebody who's done it, because then they will share the lessons and the pain and how they overcame those pain points, so that when you run into it, you're okay.
I'll go to that side now. This gentleman there.
Hi, Russ Shaw, founder of Tech London Advocates. Actually, question to you, Chris, but for the entire panel. You're talking a lot about corporate support and corporate support for scale-ups. Can you share two or three examples of large corporates who you think really do this very well? And what's the secret ingredient that they have for doing this very well? Is it culturally driven? Is it leadership driven? Is it something else?
Thanks, Russ. Well, the booklets I've got out in the front here have got basically an entire section at the back of examples. So, but in the interest of time, I'll give you one example. I think Dell is a company that has done this really, really well. So one of the things that they have done is they looked internally and they realized that one of the barriers for them was actually a cultural barrier. So they looked across the organization and actually instigated entrepreneurial KPIs for their senior management. So all of the senior staff, at the end of the year, come their annual reviews. They are asked to report on what they have done in the year that is entrepreneurial. Where have they thought outside of the box? Where have they gone beyond their job description in order to take a bit of a risk? So that I think that's a fantastic example that's worked really well. As I say, a number of other examples here of organisations that have done something similar, or you know, allowed people to take time out to sort of pursue new ventures and so on.
Okay. You published a list of the top 25 large corporates who were doing it well. So you should give yourself a plug for what you've done, because okay, that was yes. an extraordinary
so
list.
One thing that we did, Nested did as part of the Startup Europe Partnership, we had a ranking early this year that we published in June this year of what we thought were the top 25 corporates in Europe who were doing this particularly well, who were working with startups and scale-ups. Top of the list was Cisco. We also had companies like Unilever, Rabobank up there as well. This was not purely about procurement, but some of them, were there because they had re-engineered the organization to procure very effectively. Some of them were there because they had thought very hard about their culture. Some of them were there because they had examined all of their processes to kind of make them startup friendly. So that list is available online if anyone would like to have a look at it.
The lady at the back there.
Hello, this is Yichen Yan, master student from LSE Management and Strategy. And I've recently I'm doing my job application, and you can tell I'm in Asia. So I've been turned down by lots of scale-up boutique consulting companies. And just follow up the question of the Brexit, how possibly do you think that the scale-up visa that you mentioned before is going to take effect, or how...
I think it's early to, I mean, there's a lot in that discussion that's going on, as you know, and I think the UK government and across the country are putting their minds to a view of how do we make that as effective as possible. So I think we have one idea, there will be other ideas. I think this is about how we move that forward in the right way in these coming months.
And the only thing I would add to that is if you can't identify them easily, it's really hard to have a visa to give one for them, because you spend a lot of time trying to identify and verify if the thing actually is a scale up.
Yeah.
Hi, Elias Koros is from Hermes. We invest in both small and large companies. Question, I guess, for the Scale Up Institute, which you touched on earlier a couple of times ago. I was wondering, in terms of the parameters for admission and then graduation from the Scale Up Institute, you touched on the admission in terms of number of people and annual growth rate. I was wondering if you had other dimensions that you had been considering. And secondly, on the graduation front, what it is that you're thinking of doing with the companies that, when does that happen, and what are you doing with the companies that that graduate?
Well, there is no concept of graduating from being a scale-up. We would like people to continue scaling up And I would personally love the first trillion-pound company to be something that, again, has scaled and continued to scale. And then I hope that they have great policies for procurement with other scale-ups afterwards. But I think it's to scale and to keep on scaling and to give back and to be a good citizen. And the admission, again, anybody can be a scale-up. They just have to create an innovative product that the customers want and want so much that they keep on buying it. That's what I love about it. You know, the people who, the arbiters of choice are the customers, and the only way you can get a customer to buy more is by listening to them and creating something that they really want. And that's something that all of us businesses and all of us entrepreneurs should aspire to and should be capable of.
Could I just come in on that? Because I think the joy of the scale-up approach is that it directs attention to the need to address the opportunity that scale-up companies provide to the economy and their importance in growing the economy. But actually the concept, I think, is valid as an approach to supporting business, irrespective almost of the scale of the business at any given point in time. The idea of bespoke programs that work with the grain and the particular needs of the company, I think, is really the heart of this. And I would hope that there will come a day that we just do that automatically for in line with the particular needs either of a sector or a city, and are able to flex between different sectoral needs and different needs at points in time.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of a growing company as a distinct from a large one or a small or a medium-sized one or a young one, you know, if you want to focus on startups and therefore entrepreneurship, you'll have policies that you have to have birthed your company less than 5 years ago. And, well, what happens if you're a life science company and it took you 12 years to get the product market fit, but you don't qualify for any support because you're more than 5 years old. So again, the growth is the important thing, and the fact that the customers are voting with their wallets.
Yeah.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Gabriel Buck. I'm a non-exec director and advisor to a number of scale-up institutions. I'm also the chairman of the British Bankers Association on Export Finance and Trade. I've been in this business 35 years. And the questions about aspiration and motivation here in the UK versus other countries. And I have two bugbearers about the UK more than anything else, even though I'm a big taxpayer here. That is, one, owner-managers seem to have here in the UK a drive to earn money up to a certain level, but when they get to that certain level, they're not really that keen to move forward. They don't have that aspiration to float and really scale up, even though the business model that they have is very strong. And the second question that I see is a big concern I have here in the UK is that the link between government, industry and banking is not as strong as in other countries. Mm-hmm. And on those two questions, I'd be really interested in your viewpoints.
Elizabeth, I think we'd like to take the first one. I'll take something else. Elizabeth.
There is an element in Australia. I'm an adopted Brit, but I was raised in Australia. There is the concept of the tall poppy syndrome, where to actually grow your company beyond a certain level means you raise your head above the parapet and you really do need to develop a thicker skin. So the concept that a lot of the woes of the world are because, you know, there are the tax-avoiding millionaires and things like that. So up until a certain point, there's a social convention that it's okay to be a small business person and you know, you're doing good. And then beyond that, there is a different psychology. And that's part of the journey, I think, of just saying, get a thick skin. And ally with other people that are going on a similar journey.
I think I'd as well pick up the point. I think, Rob, I saw it when I was in Swindon and Wiltshire, and one of the business owners there said, is this for me? And part of it, Gabby, is unlocking that potential. Sometimes it is, I'm really growing fast, and oh my gosh, I think I better put the brakes on. I think, Rob, you said it, one of the businesses said that to you, because they felt it was out of control, and they didn't have the help around them to support them. And I think that's where the local environment that's here in this table in Rowena and the team here is really important, because it's often not realizing that support is there, and it can hold people back. I've spoken to many family businesses that want to grow, and they're just trying to wear that out. I mean, Rob and James and Rowena, you might have views on that.
Just a thought on that one. I think it's quite true, but I think it's encouraging a business to see that actually the person who started that business and took it to whatever level it is might not be the person to take it to the next level. We've had that discussion with several businesses, gently, obviously, and politically and carefully, but actually a change of CEO, to say to the guy who's taking it to, let's say, a 10, 15 million turnover business, actually, you'd be better off now as the innovation director, because that's what you really like doing. You're not really up for running a £50 million company, but maybe you need to bring somebody else in to do that. It doesn't mean necessarily that you've got to exit the company. So I think sometimes they self-elect to do it. Other times they need some encouragement to say, I'm not the right person. I mean, that's not always the case. Sometimes you can take them through that journey. But coming from that banking background, same as you, I think that's often a key issue,
James,
because there's a whole set of new things, as has been said, you know, a whole set of new issues come into play once you get to a certain level, and some people are just not up for that, so lack of ambition is an issue.
If I may, I think there's a couple of things which can potentially address that. One comes back to these role models, and not only can role models help you out in terms of getting over a particular topic, so I'm about to float, I need to talk to somebody who's done it before, but actually that peer-to-peer network which has could reinvigorate and sort of re-inspire, or help somebody realise actually it's time to hand over the reins to another who may take it forward. Indeed, the business I came out of 3 months ago, it's been around 25 years, and the last 2 years it's a scaling business, not the 23 before it. It was led by an organic synthetic chemist, and he realised that actually it hit the point where he could take it no further, and so it needed something different, so his role's changed. So I think there are ways, but I would bring it back to that opportunity of the role model, that opportunity of the peer-to-peer network. It can be there as a shoulder to cry on, but it can actually hopefully for many reinvigorate them and say, actually, yes, you're taking it onto this, but what about the next bit?
And I think that what I would say is we found plenty of people who were really very ambitious, but they'd met the limits of their skill sets. And it's for those people that we really are focused on. It could be that lots more people maybe who don't have that ambition at the moment get excited after they see that, but we're focused on, for those that have the ambition and the world-class products, getting rid of the barriers that exist in this country and in some environments, and even in some cities more than others, helping them overcome those barriers. Because if they're ambitious, they shouldn't meet those barriers. And if a barrier is something to do with knowledge, then we can impart that to them really easily, and we should.
Two other things I would just add. One is the champion the role of the non-exec director on the board. And I think every owner-managed business should be encouraged to have really strong non-executive directorships, directors on the board. And kind of linked to that, to be very careful about how your investors are represented on your board, because the structure of equity finance and debt finance can itself be very constraining or encouraging in terms of taking that next step in growth.
I think just to come full circle, I agree with all of my learned colleagues here. But I do go back to the national culture. If you have a look at the countries that are very encouraging and inspiring, I mean, the Britain is great, and Entrepreneurship is Great program from the Department of International Trade actually has really been very inspiring. It actually is cool to get out there and do something different, whereas before that, I genuinely felt that there were those constraints, and you're pushing or you're swimming against the tide. There is a lot of help in terms of even your bank can introduce you to people who are non-execs, but it is that psychological barrier. It is cool to be entrepreneurial, so get out there and do something about it. And I think the US is totally shameless about things like that.
I think the banks, just one final point I just make, I think there is insight that the financiers, the banks and others that work with businesses have around the earlier question about what is a growth pattern. And I think the more our banking industry and others can start looking at the growth patterns of their businesses they're doing business with, the more they can help them as well.
Gentlemen there.
Thank you. My name is Kebby Sebastian. I'm the MD of a scale-up in the fintech space, and my question is around talent, which is a challenge for us. And given at all levels, whether it's recent graduates or more experienced hires, given there are several educational institutions involved in these scale-up institutes, I was curious as to whether there's any initiative to connect, for example, recent graduates with potential employers or scale-ups.
I think that's a great. I think that's a great idea, and it's interesting what you've just said there comes through a lot of the different commentary that goes behind some of the results that we shared. And I think, you know, what I'm very encouraged about, and Sherry, you spoke about it as a recommendation, is how the business schools and universities, they've been part of the program, but they're also that we spoke about in Birmingham and Manchester, but also how they're really thinking harder about what they do with the graduate population and businesses locally. The Small Business Charter, not many people may know of, but the Small Business Charter is a whole consortium of our business schools and universities, you know, and we're working very closely with them about how they can further look at the talent pool they have. And Rowena, I don't know if you want to talk about what Manchester's doing and some of the things in that area overall.
I think graduate apprenticeships are a wonderful initiative. They're gathering pace certainly in Manchester, and I think in other cities as well. I think that's a great concept. Our business school, one of our two business schools in Manchester, is now developing courses to be run for next year, which are actually adopting the scale-up principles to their teaching. So early steps, but...
And I think I'd point out the Careers and Enterprise company that was created, and I have to say it, Founders for Schools. I think getting the scale-up leaders into the classrooms as early as 8, so that you can consider it as a viable and interesting and fulfilling career, is really important. And as long as we have business leaders that are willing to go sit in a classroom, be it with in front of 8-year-olds or 15-year-olds or you know, lower 6, upper 6, or first year or third year university, it's absolutely critical. I know you've got a thriving entrepreneurship club here, Saul, and it does a huge credit, and that makes an enormous difference to all of us. But we shouldn't just start at university, because people form their views very, very early on in life.
This operates at a number of levels, and I think one which I'd just draw attention to is a program we run, which is a scholarship, a Saltire Scholar internship program, and that actively goes to all of the universities in Scotland, invites people to come forward, and the nature of the internship is with a whole mixture of companies. It's got a global dimension to it in particular, but more recently we've been actively looking for scale-up companies that can offer a meaningful experience. Now, not the easiest things to accommodate, we do understand that, but where they have been able to do that, they've had an experience of some really tremendous talent coming through. That's broadened the mind of the talent coming out. Mm-hmm. That's gone back into that alumni population in its own right. But actually, we've had a number of examples where people have, not that long later, gone back and got involved. So I think more should be done, but it's an important area to try and connect those dots. And if we can get it right from the beginning by sowing those seeds at age 8 and allowing that to be seen to be cool as you go through, but then actively connecting that entrepreneur, that sort of mindset, those that are coming through this system who've engaged in these clubs, and then giving them experiences in companies that have got that mindset in its own right. You know, it's got to be a good recipe. And we've seen, albeit at a modest level, that start to work, and we hope to see that grow, and I hope to see more of that around the country.
I'd like to share an experience. I actually sit on the governing board of the University Technology College in Media City in Manchester, and as one of the governors, I wander around, and obviously I speak to the teachers and the principal, but also the students, and they love being given, if you get a really good industry engagement, they love being given real-world problems that they can seem to be solving. It makes their learning relevant. And also, just a little bit of I'm not really a role model for an 8-year-old or a 17-year-old, but I sort of open their eyes to, like, one of the things I say to them about being cool, I said, do you think it's cool to own the latest iPhone? What's really cool is to be the designer and the creator of it. Now that's cool. And they open their eyes and go, oh, wow. You know, getting your parents to buy you the latest iPhone, it's like, so what? But you want to change the world and you really want to be a cool kid? Be the designer, be the creator. And they, a lot of them have never actually been challenged that way. And we have no problems in attracting talent, funnily enough.
It's very true, very good testament.
Just one other point. We are very reticent and modest, as a generalisation, but as a nation we are very reticent and modest about boasting about success. And as well as developing role models from age 8, getting our successful businesses out there, up in lights, and shouting about what they do and just being openly proud and celebratory of it, that will help as well.
Very true.
Now, I know there's a lot of people with their hands up, but we've actually gone past the witching hour of 8 o'clock. I'm pleased to say that the panel are going to be staying on, and there'll be drinks outside, and I'm sure they'll be very happy to take other questions. I'd just like to say what a pleasure it's been to chair this session. Usually, you know, one chairs these events. There's one speaker, you hear a view. Here, you know, we've had 7 speakers, we've heard 7 views, we've sort of surrounded the problem, and it's been very insightful. Thank you very much indeed.